This show furnished by Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervey's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervey. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kaysen. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervey and Kerry Kaysen.
A good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am Alan Gervey, and welcome to Gervey's Law. I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, as you just heard. And today, as usual, I'm here to be the managing partner of your life. My co-host, Kerry Kaysen, is not with me, unfortunately. She is all tied up today, so I am going to go at it solo, and we have a very interesting show. We have one of the top scholars in the country. In fact, he was named the most extraordinary legal scholar of this generation, or at least one of them, and whose research and teaching and writing has been brought clarity to law and life throughout the last few generations, that's for sure. He is the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU School of Law, and he is also the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor of Law Emeritus and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. He was once a professor at the University of Southern California and has had an incredible career of blogging, of speaking, lecturing, and has all kinds of irons in the fire on so many issues, it will make your head spin. We will learn a lot today. Professor Epstein, how are you doing?
Well, it's always nice to be here.
First of all, before we get into specific issues with you, Richard, tell us how this perspective that you have evolved over time. What were the influences in your life where you got to where you are today?
Okay, well, I guess that goes back a long time, and, you know, you sort of get self-knowledge from yourself in the most extraordinary kinds of ways. And one of the things I realized from the time I was about 10 years old was that I was sort of good at everything and great at nothing. I mean, you know, I was a pretty good math student, pretty good English student, pretty good this, pretty good that. But there was nothing about me which was remotely like a prodigy or anything close. But when you put all this stuff together, it slowly dawned on me that the sort of set of skills that I had, reasonably good quantitative, verbal, good memory, curiosity to go out the wazoo, actually was a fairly nice combination if you sort of lauded it down with one thing. Common sense, so that you never went off the rails with some kind of crazy theory that was, by and large, improbable, even if novel. And then the next thing I discovered, somewhere around ninth grade, is if somebody wound me up, put me on the stage, and had me start talking, I'd just keep going.
I can see that.
I mean, it didn't matter what the topic was or how long it went. And, you know, that's a kind of a unique skill.
It is.
On the other hand, I have to tell you, I can't memorize anything. I mean, literally, I have no exact memory. Or as I like to say when I talk about given topics, I have enough trouble talking about the same theme once. And in the course of most of my lectures, I start out with some sense as to where I'm going. And halfway through the thing, it turns out that I'm off in some other kind of a range. And so when I got the situation to college, I also realized that I had another really important academic weakness, which was a kind of academic attention deficit. That is, you asked me to sit down and work in a library and go in great detail and to learn something about a particular text and so forth. I'd start writing notes, and then I would lose them, and then I'd forget where I was, and I'd be thinking about something else. And it became very clear to me that archival research or anything closely like it was completely foreign to my psychology. But at the same time, I realized that if I kind of darted around from here, there, and the other place, I could sort of put everything together sort of on the fly. And so when I was a college student, what I did is I didn't major in anything consistent with my lackadaisical behaviors. And what I did is I studied, you know, a lot of different subjects at a fairly superficial level. So I was not a bad physics student, and I took a lot of that, took a lot of chemistry, at least for a ne'er-do-well, took a fair bit of mathematics, I did a lot of philosophy, did a lot of sociology and political theory, but nothing in particular. And I could remember when I applied, did not get the Rhodes Scholarship. You know, they asked me what I majored in, and I said nothing at all, and I had to explain for 5 minutes why it was that I had concocted this peculiar academic record. Well, this, it turns out, maps very well into law. Lawyers essentially don't have to be a master of everything, of anything, but they really have to be very quick in going from one topic to another, and they have to be able to see analogies and comparisons, extract principles, and put them together. And from a fairly early age, it was quite clear to me that somehow or other, notwithstanding all the other things that I couldn't do, this was something that I could do. And I was very fortunate. I studied law first in Oxford, and I managed to begin my legal education with Roman law as my career. And my first law school assignment, matched by nobody in the United States, was to trace the development of the contract of stipulatio from the 12 tables to Justinian. If you don't think that's impressive, it's 1,000 years, but it's 1,000 years long ago. And so I became something of a Romanist, which I still am, something of a medieval legal historian, which I still am. And I had all the sort of Oxford virtues and none of the American kind of instrumentalism that comes when you got fancy constitutional law, or when you put yourself into a situation where everybody's talking policy, where you have all sorts of complicated federal issues. And through all of this experience, I managed to develop a pretty coherent view of what the basic set of individual entitlements ought to be as between persons.
And so what you're saying, Richard, I just have to interrupt because it doesn't sound like anyone had any influence on you because, you know, we talk to lawyers all the time, we talk to politicians, and they all say this person or that person, this train of thought or this, that one did. But you're saying that this all was something that came from within you. So how do we expect that the average person would be able to determine what they want to do when they grow up, so to speak?
Okay, well, let me sort of correct it. I was telling you what the process is. I mean, what I did not have and what I strongly urge all students not to have is a supervisor or a mentor. Because what happens is once you fall in the shadow of a serious major figure, it's very difficult for you to figure out what's going on. That doesn't mean that you don't have people who influence you. And in fact, you know, I could go back to Miss Feldman in ninth grade who explained to me the way in which you were supposed to read various kinds of novels like Ivanhoe and so forth, and had a lot of effect on me. When I was in college, I studied with some very serious people like Ernest Nagel and Sidney Morgan Besser and David Sidorsky, and I learned, and Daniel Bell, and I learned a lot from that. When I was in England in law school, Brian Simpson and Bernard Rudden and a bunch of other people really did have some day-to-day influence on me, but I always kept my academic independence from anybody because it occurred to me that the set of things that I put together was different from other people. And so when I got back to the Yale Law School, thank God I was not a first-year Yale Law student,
right.
So it was kind of independent of the sort of socialization into American realism that dominated the studies in the 1960s. And by the time I go on to the market, I'm a third-year student. I can still remember going out to USC and talking to everybody, and they looked at me like I was somebody who came out of a very weird ancient China shop. But we talked and talked and talked. My interview schedule at that time was 13 hours, and I have to confess, although people still refuse to believe it, that my last interview on this one day, the only job interview I had at the time, was in a topless bar. Such was Los Angeles in November of 1967.
Still the same.
And so, you know, I get out there, and the dean asks me what I want to teach, and I just look at it kind of puzzled, like, is that a serious request? And she said, yes. I said, well, what do you want me to teach? And that's what I taught, whatever she wanted me to teach. So I've always been willing to do all those kinds of things, and there is a real advantage, as I like to tell my students, to two things. One is superficiality. If you really get so deep into one area, you never look at anything else, and the law of diminishing marginal returns takes over. So you'll want, to some extent, to be sort of superficial. And then what you want to be able to do is to connect the dots across different fields, which depends upon the former element. And if you can do that, what happens is you can take your Roman law stuff, as I've done, and say, you know, you really want to understand how to do constitutional interpretation, read the Lex Aquilae, that is the Roman statute dealing with wrongful injury. And it actually works pretty well. So that's what I've done throughout my kind of academic career. At the beginning, it was extremely difficult to learn how to write. But as you get better at this, it's like making a wedding cake, you know, just how much batter to mix up for what it is that you want to do. And so you don't over-research or under-research. And then the other thing you develop when you do as much writing as I do, you get a sixth sense as to when you're off the rails and stop. And at other times, you're sitting there, you start something. I said, page later, I didn't think of that. Who wrote that? And then you just keep on going. So what you do is you follow your gut to some of these expenses. What I like to say as a kind of a message about this is sometimes when I give a speech, I know where I'm going to begin, but I'll start a sentence without knowing how it's going to end. And that's the way I do my radio interviews. So it is a kind of an odd situation. I've had many people tell me, don't you ever advise anybody on what they're supposed to do if they become an academic, because you're such an unusual character.
You are unusual, and I got to tell you something. When we talk about the country as a whole now and what we're facing, you talk a lot about the politics, about the election coming up.
Yeah.
How do you understand what really goes on in the minds of middle America or people who are not you? Because you've got such a sophisticated brain, but it seems that a lot of people are looking at this election from a very different perspective.
Well, I think, one of the things about this that I didn't mention is I always believe that you have to check one system of thought against another. And so, to some extent, I'm a highly abstract theoretician who's trying to figure out how various principles of social optimality constrain the organization of legal rules. But on the other hand, I've always tried to say that if I give a particular problem to a particular person of no particular academic background and explain what it is about and how it goes, it has to be able to resonate with him. That is, law to some extent is theory, but to some extent you're trying to capture dominant patterns. And so when you teach a class like property and you talk about the first possession rule and so forth, one of the things you often do is you stop and you look at the class with highly divergent political views and so forth, and you give them a question of whether or not a finder of an object is able to prevail against its true owners. Talk about it for a while, and then you discover that you could actually get to a high level of commonality amongst people whose politics is very different. And so, to me, it's always a question of going between the high theory on the one hand and the day-to-day expectations. Because in ordinary life, if you come up with a set of rules which essentially deviates from the expectations and understanding of everybody who has to live under them, you know that your system is going to be a failure. So you put these two things together and you hope to get it. Now, what's going on in the current situation? Well, that's a slightly different problem. There is a kind of a typology between people who are elitists and people who are everyday guys. I'm sort of in between them, but it's very clear if you look at the people who support Donald Trump, it's not what he's for. It's what he's against that attracts them. And what they do is they see that the elites that come from the Democratic Party are essentially, as far as they're concerned only with certain kinds of issues for certain classes of their constituents, but they don't have much interest in the ordinary anonymous guy, the forgotten man of Richard Nixon or the ordinary Joe of Spiro Agnew. They really feel an alienation from that. But they feel a similar alienation from what they regard as white shoe country club Republicans who essentially run the kind of business establishment. And these attitudes, to some extent, are healthy because they give a corrective against the elitism in the United States, but they can easily lead you into all sorts of mistakes on matters in which, you know, the elitists are actually right. And so, I mean, one of the striking features about this election is the massive repudiation starting in both the Republican and the Democratic Party as against free trade. I mean, I was raised on free trade because I believe in freedom of contract within a given country. Two people getting together can do more in a combined fashion voluntarily than they could do separately. And if they live in different countries, the same thing is true. And if you could accelerate the set of voluntary transactions that exchange goods and services, so much the better. And now all of a sudden it turns out that this is the enemy to American people and it robs jobs. And what it is, it's sort of anecdotal jurisprudence. Somebody loses a job to a competitor. They don't know whether they've lost the job to somebody in Indiana on the one hand or in France on the other hand. They're just angry. And they think if they shut out the foreign stuff, it's going to help them. But, of course, what happens is if there are imports that you need in the United States to make goods for export or to lower the price of consumer goods, you're going to be cutting off your nose to fight spite the face. And you can't get any of these political people to actually point out the fact that there's no way you're going to make the public at large richer or happier or better if you shrink the pie of available social goods. And so I'm sitting here, and I try to explain this to ordinary people, but you run into this huge buzzsaw of resistance. And one of the things that I find is that my classical liberalism, small, limited government, flat taxes, right, modest regulation, security of voluntary transactions, doesn't resonate with anybody today. Whereas in the 1980s, when Reagan took over, there actually was some systematic movement in that direction. So, I like to think that I'm very prominent, quote, as a classical libertarian, but may I be the captain of a large ship instead of the tiny tub that I'm on now, because most people do not want to follow this particular path. it is striking when you get into public life how much everybody sort of tailors it around. And my view is you never compromise on these issues. You continue to believe what you believe in good times. And
belief is good. We have to take a quick break. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
To be made any knowingly false or fraudulent material statement or material representation for the purposes of obtaining workers' compensation benefits is guilty of a felony.
Another day at work. The pain is getting worse, and I'm afraid to say anything because I need this job, and I don't want to get fired. If I wasn't the only one supporting the family, I'd quit.
Is this you? Are you suffering every day while your injuries get worse, and there seems to be nowhere to turn? Or do you have an injury that was brought on gradually by repetitive motion, and now you can't perform your job duties at all? For over 35 years, the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn has represented those who have sustained an injury on the job or have become disabled as a result of work. They're the experts in workers' compensation. You need an advocate. You need someone who cares about the injured worker. You need the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn to get you through the nightmare. Friends, if you're suffering with a cumulative work injury, the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn is in business to help you. Find out more. Call the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, 855-4-RGW-LAW. That's 855-4-RGW-LAW. Or go to rgwlawfirm.com. First consultations are free.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome.
Divinely.
Cabaret.
Dangerously.
Cabaret to cabaret.
Decadent. Roundabout Theater Company's Cabaret.
Coming to Segerstrom Center for the Arts August 9th through 21st.
Norm's has two ways to make your mouth water.
Enjoy your SoCal Day sunny side up with Norm's USDA Choice Sirloin Steak and Eggs. Two eggs, two hotcakes, and hash browns. Sunny, sunny, sunny. Only $8.99.
Or stack up your rack with Norm's Baby Back Ribs. Complete rib dinners with golden fried shrimp, crispy chicken tenders, or juicy sirloin steak.
Oh, baby.
Starting at $11.99. Soup and salad included. Served all day.
Norm's is SoCal.
Norm's Restaurants, where life happens. Open 24/7.
18 locations. Normsrestaurants.com.
In 3, 2, 1.
Coming up on the next drive home with Jillian Barbary and John Phillips, we find out if any of our Olympic athletes have diphtheria yet.
Oh!
Live and local, right after Dr. Drew and Psycho Mike, right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to Gervais Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
We are back right here in Gervais Law. We're talking to Richard Epstein, who is the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU School of Law, James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor of Law Emeritus and Senior Lecturer at University of Chicago. Richard, I want to ask you about the Supreme Court. First of all, is the possibility of Supreme Court justices being appointed by the new president enough to rally people around Donald Trump?
No. I don't think so.
Why not?
I mean, I think clearly the single smartest thing that Donald Trump did when he was campaigning was to put out a list of 12 sensible Republican judges, where everyone on the list had some respectable claim for future appointments.
Right.
But to most people, I think this issue is just way back on the queue compared to, you know, instability in foreign affairs, immigration, economic uncertainty inside the United States, police violence, and so forth. So that they will regard the immediate and short term as much more important than any long term influence on the judiciary. And my view about it is that on that question, they're basically right. The problem, of course, for Mr. Trump is it's not at all clear that he knows what he is talking about on any of these particular issues. And he faces
things that don't matter, like Muslims. But let's talk about the Supreme Court justices for a minute. So, first of all, we had Brian Leiter on the show, and he called the Supreme Court a super legislature. Now, if that's true, that means that we're looking at politicians, and they may be shaping all of these issues that are important to people more than the president himself. When we talk about Second Amendment, look what Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote, and I know you've been critical of her when she talked about Trump, but is she just a politician? Is she now campaigning for Hillary Clinton?
Well, Well, look, I mean, the question is, have the Supreme Court justices so involved themselves in the fray that they sound like politicians? I think to some extent the answer to that question is yes. But remember, once she realized that even her supporters thought that this was a royally stupid thing to do,
right,
she shut up and said she'd never do it again. And
but
I think
she did it. She did it. It's telling us what the mindset of these Supreme Court justices are.
Well, at least of this Supreme Court justice and probably of others. But, I mean, if you actually wanted to ask that question, I pretty much know the mindset of virtually all the justices. What's dangerous is you don't want somebody to commit themselves publicly because you don't think you could get a fair shake in front of them, whereas if they don't babble on about something or other, you think at least they're going to listen to you. So I think, in fact, it was an important social convention. She realized she violated it, and it went. Now, I disagree with Brian about the super legislature characteristic, at least on one reading. The sense in which this is surely correct is you give me any particular text and any clever justice could come up with any argument in any case in any way.
Right, right.
And so the notion that somehow or other the text binds these people, given the past history, people don't believe it. That doesn't mean that they're all equally right. And in fact, I spent my entire career dealing with such things as the Takings Clause, pushing a very different view that there's only one way in which you can actually analyze this thing correctly if you understand what the text is about, where it came from, how it fits in with common law rules. But there's another sense in which even if they do this, they're not a super legislature. They have no administrative force that is associated with them. The actions that they do will generally take a long time to deal with. They may be able to invalidate a lot of laws, but generally speaking, they can't pass any laws that they want to do. The closest they've ever gotten to that has been efforts to try and require the legislature to fund improvements in various kinds of prison cases. And for the most part, they've been met with a lot of resistance on all of that stuff. So they don't have the power of the purse. They don't have the power of the military. They don't have the ability to put into place large and comprehensive administrative schemes. So to most people, I mean, they really care about these issues, but they care about them more in an emotional way. So to kind of put it in perspective, if you take abortion, there's no question that it's a hot-button issue. It's right at the top of the list. But if you try to figure out what it's going to do to the way in which people lead their daily lives, the whole range of options that they have are relatively small. So you invalidate, as they should have done given current law, the Texas situation, whole woman's health, and you go back to the status quo ante with respect to the availability of abortion. It's not as though there's a great transformation. So
should Hillary...
important that the Supreme Court do things right, but a lot of their most important cases nobody cares about. They don't
That's
care about
true.
Bankruptcy
That's very
priorities
true.
And
but,
stuff like that.
But, Richard, should Hillary Clinton say that when she's president she's going to make sure that Citizens United is overturned?
Well, I mean, she's a politician, and she's not a very good one on these things. It is ironic to realize that the thing she wants to overturn was a broadcast of a political nature against her candidacy and so forth.
Right.
And that Citizens United, if you look at it, is not a normal corporation. It's a political advocacy group. And her position has this sort of built-in absurdity that if you don't incorporate and you simply do this as a partnership type arrangement, then you're constitutionally protected. But if you incorporate under state law, you forfeit your federal rights. That's utterly indefensible. What is so tragic about her and about most of the people who talk about this stuff is they think one-line sentences, one-line declarations of truth are sufficient to win the argument. And, you know, I don't think she could actually give a reasoned argument as to why she's right on Citizens United.
Richard, do you believe that Citizens United is playing a role in this election now?
Well, the narrow decision is one which, yeah, it's a minor role, but what it's doing is it says that you can't stop people from broadcasting a political broadside about a candidacy within 30 or 60 days of an election. I mean, so what it does is it opens up speech. The irony is it doesn't open it up for just the rich fat cats, whoever they may be. I think it's pretty clear today if you actually look at the change in American businesses, the new tech businesses tend to be run by people like Tim Cook and Bill Gates and so forth, and Mark Zuckerberg. These are guys who have left the Senate.
And they're certainly not supporting Trump and the Republican Party in this election.
And Republicans are not supporting
Well, that's true,
Trump.
Too. But isn't it true that perhaps Citizens United is actually helping Hillary Clinton?
Well, the current decision, look, there's no question that the money, the smart money, has moved Democratic. If you check the hedge funds, I think, you know, people gave, you know, $269 to Donald Trump, a total figure of under $1 million, and she's got close to $50 million from these people. Yes, I mean, I think the American landscape is a very different place from what it was 50 years ago, where all your CEOs were MBAs, you know, from respectable places at 55 years of age. Now you get 27-year-old billionaires
exactly.
that are calling the trend, and they are basically much more hip and groovy than the guys that they replace. So it's the kind of cunning of reason. What you do is you get to bash at the Citizens United case to prove that you really are a man or a woman of the people, and then you rake in the dough from your friends so long as the decision remains
and,
on
and
the
Richard,
vote.
Isn't it also true that technology today really has an impact on campaigning versus what we expected from Citizens United many years ago? Maybe that was the case with the influence of corporations versus what's going on in social media today. That's what's affecting.
This is clearly correct. The information system now is much more decentralized. To give you a concrete example, when Bob Bork was up in 1987,
yeah.
The newspapers could report the morning on the hearings, but they ignored everything that the Republicans said on the afternoon. Today, it's just instant stream of coverage by people from every point of view. So even if the press is, say, 80 or 85% Democrat, what happens is the counterweight comes from all of these small sites, many of which are either libertarian or conservative or social conservative or something of the sort. So there's nobody who controls a monopoly over the information flow, which is one of the reasons why you don't want to take after Citizens United as if somehow or other this matters to a disproportionate amount. And you're surely correct that the decentralization of information through social media and so forth is, in fact, much greater than it was. For heaven's sake, Donald Trump runs half of his campaign on Twitter.
That's right. And to your point, I don't think people really care about Citizens United, and maybe the Supreme Court's decision in that case isn't as relevant as the real issues that we need to be talking about. But just before we finish talking about the Supreme Court, let's talk about Merrick Garland for a second, because I know you've been critical of your old college professor, law school professor, colleague, President Obama, and you've been, of course, very critical of Trump and Clinton. Where do you fall with Merrick Garland? Isn't it true that there should have been, according to the Constitution, Obama's still in power? They should have had the hearings, and
no,
they. Why is it just convenient?
No, I mean, look. First of all, let's just go through the constitutional text. What it does is it puts an obligation on the president to essentially nominate.
Right.
But it simply says, with the advice and Senate consent of the Senate to confirm, there's no obligation for the Senate to consider anybody. To put this in historical perspective, the nominations clause applies to all judges at the appellate and the trial level, not just the Supreme Court. The Democrats were the past masters at not giving hearings to people like Miguel Estrada on the sole ground that they were too qualified to get an appointment because they might be suitable for the Supreme Court. And so they let that one last for 15 months or some period like that without so much as giving a hearing, and nobody made the constitutional claim. The president certainly can nominate, but he cannot force them to hear. Why is it that McConnell doesn't want to do it? It's straight politics like on the other side. His attitude is if you give Merrick Garland a hearing, he will garner a large amount of public support because he's a very reasonable man, particularly on the Democratic side. He's relatively conservative, though left of center more generally.
Yeah.
And he will then put Republican senatorial candidates into an awkward position of saying, why are you posing this reasonable
man? So, Richard, isn't this a huge risk that Mitch McConnell and the Republicans are taking? Because if Hillary Clinton is elected in November,
then they have to face the music.
They're going to face the music. So why weren't they thinking, wouldn't you rather have Merrick Garland in there compared to what you may be facing when Hillary Clinton's president?
Well, it's a perfectly fair question. But remember, you started off with the constitutional issue, and now you're playing politics like everybody else. And, I mean, the other end game that one could imagine is you deny that you'll ever hear this thing. And the moment it's clear that Trump is lost, you schedule a hearing and announce that you're all willing to do it so as to make it impossible for Hillary, you think, or for Obama to pull the nomination and to put somebody further to the left on there. So the Republicans are saying, well, if we win this thing, we may be able to stop it dead, and if we lose this thing, we may be able to get back to Garland as the least unattractive of these alternatives. I mean, I find it kind of distressing. that you see such political stuff. But remember what we said about, you know, Supreme Court jurisprudence.
Right.
If it turns out any justice can make any position on these big cases that they want, then if Garland turns out to be the most reasonable of the people who's going to turn over all the 5-4 cases, the Republicans see no reason to confirm him. Remember, most cases before the Supreme Court are not in this huge class
right.
of cases on steroids.
That's true.
A lot of them come out 9-0.
And by the way, I don't know that Donald Trump would even stick to his list that he produced if he were elected. So that's another issue. We have a lot more to talk to Richard Epstein about. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We'll be right back.
I'm Nick Soboleski, a SelectQuote agent with a true story that could save you hundreds of dollars a year. A woman named Linda just called. Her husband, Ray, has a $300,000 group life insurance policy, but is changing jobs and can't take it with him. Well, I impartially shopped the highly rated term life insurance companies we represent and found Ray, who is 41 and takes medication to control his cholesterol, a 10-year, $500,000 policy for under $26 a month. That's almost twice the coverage for less than half of what he had paid. If SelectQuote hasn't shopped for your life insurance, you're probably paying too much.
For your free quote, call 1-800-597-4816. That's 1-800-597-4816. 1-800-597-4816. Or go to SelectQuote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at SelectQuote.com/commercials. Your price can vary depending on your health issuing company and other factors. Not available in all states.
Any person who makes or causes to be made any knowingly false or fraudulent material statement or material representation for the purposes of obtaining workers' compensation benefits is guilty of a felony.
Another day at work. The pain is getting worse, and I'm afraid to say anything because I need this job, and I don't want to get fired. If I wasn't the only one supporting the family, I'd quit.
Is this you? Are you suffering every day while your injuries get worse, and there seems to be nowhere to turn? Or do you have an injury that was brought on gradually by repetitive motion, and now you can't perform your job duties at all? For over 35 years, the law firm of Rowan, Gervey & Wynn has represented those who have sustained an injury on the job or have become disabled as a result of work. They're the experts in workers' compensation. You need an advocate. You need someone who cares about the injured worker. You need the law firm of Rowan, Gervey & Wynn to get you through the nightmare. Friends, if you're suffering with a cumulative work injury, the law firm of Rowan, Gervey & Wynn is in business to help you. Find out more. Call the law firm of Rowan, Gervey & Wynn, 855-4-RGW-LAW. That's 855-4-RGW-LAW. Or go to rgwlawfirm.com. First consultations are free.
Live and local.
1090
KABC.
You're listening to Gervais Law, the intersection of law and life. Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, you are listening to Gervais Law. I'm Alan Gervey. We're talking to Richard Epstein. Professor Epstein writes a legal column called The Libertarian and is a contributor to Ricochet.com and SCOTUS blog. He is prolific. He has an opinion on everything. And I know you have an opinion on an issue that I want to talk about right now. I want to talk about FBI Director James Comey and his review of the Hillary Clinton emails, Professor Epstein. Now, as a lawyer, isn't it the case that we review evidence and we apply the law to the evidence, and if there is a breach of the law, then we would prosecute, as the law would suggest. So it's not necessarily a political thing, but you're going to tell me it is, obviously. But what is going on with James Comey? Can't he figure out, how can he say one thing in the media and then apparently do something other than what he says in practice?
Well, first of all, I think you have to understand this whole thing was a giant screw-up from start to beginning, from start to end. Let me make one simple observation.
Yeah.
There are lots of very complicated legal issues on mens rea, the mental state, actus reus, the wrongful act. There's serious issues associated with obstruction of justice in this particular case by wiping it clean. There are all sorts of ancillary offenses that could be gained against the people who were in communication with her on this private network and the lawyers who wiped the server and all the rest of this stuff. As best I can tell from what has been said, nobody in the Justice Department had prepared any legal memos during the course of the FBI investigation. As best I can tell from what has been said, the FBI, which normally gathers information, did not prepare any memos either. So the only legal analysis that we seem to be available is the actual 15-minute riff that Comey gave in this particular case. Now, it's also chock full with arguable errors, and it's incomplete on a number of particular grounds. But the first thing to understand is, why in the world is he talking publicly?
Good point. It is not the FBI's business
to do this. But what happens is you have this situation, and you know, was it or was it not orchestrated? I cannot say. You get Bill Clinton going and talking with Loretta Lynch, and he says he only spoke to her about small talk. My guess is that's exactly what he did. But then what she does is she says it was a terrible mistake for him to do this, appearance of injustice. Well, then she picks the wrong remedy. The correct thing for her to do is to say, I've hopelessly compromised myself. I'm out of this case. She didn't say that. She said, I will follow the advice of Mr. Comey, which is wrong. It's not his job to give her advice. It's not his job to give her advice in public. What he does is submit his evidence, and then what she should say is, I'm having other people inside the Justice Department guaranteeing their independence, and they will review this particular case. But she didn't do this. So then what he does is he gets on stage, which he ought not to do, says, look, she did terrible things, A plus B plus C. Looks like it's an indictable offense, but I don't think I could bring this particular case. And then she says, case closed, just like that.
And of course, she also added that she didn't lie and that he indicated that she was very truthful, which is...
Yes, well, I mean, one of the other things, of course, which I think is noticed, when did you interview Mrs. Clinton? And they said basically at the end of the process. This is not standard procedure. The standard procedure of the FBI is you always interview the potential suspect very early on, force them to make statements when they are ignorant about what the evidence will turn up one way or another, and then could use that in order to impeach them if it turns out that they've told a falsehood, which then gives rise to a whole series of other collateral charges, including perjury if it's in the stand or obstruction of justice and so forth. So by giving the delay, it gave her a huge advantage. Then they just slow walked the investigation. They took 15 months or so to do this thing, and they didn't even ask the right questions as far as I'm concerned. So by the time he gets there, Comey can say to himself, and he's a good guy, by the way, do I want to sink Hillary's nomination on the eve of the convention by announcing she's subject to an indictment?
Never going
to
happen.
Myself to do that. I'm too powerful. Yeah. If he had said it privately, then they would have had to make the decision. So what we do is we get this carefully orchestrated situation in which you will note that nobody actually made a definitive judgment on this thing as a legal matter. Nobody did the research, and she and all of her buddies walk free. Now, the people who are on the Trump side of the line, this is cynicism incarnate. You have Comey, who's a Republican but an establishment type, graduate of the University of Chicago Law School, in fact, and you get Mrs. Clinton, and you get Loretta Lynch, you get everybody who's kind of a big shot. And what they manage to do is to execute a scenario which is blindingly effective but manages to circumvent every standard rule that one wants to use. On the merits, you know, Comey didn't do such a good job. The question you have to ask is, what's the mens rea? He says, well, we don't know whether they leaked it to the Russians. I think that's obviously the wrong question. The question is whether or not she can escape the rules about dealing with keeping this information in a compromised place, because it never was on a government server to begin with, and so therefore could not have been downloaded. And that's a kind of a legal nit. Of course she should be held responsible.
And well, let me ask you something, Richard. Let me ask you something
here.
Go ahead. Finish up, and then I want to ask you something on this.
To make sure under these cases that nobody puts this information in a position of vulnerability. And it's not just the Russians who hacked this. My guess is that the line forms on the left, and there are probably 20 nations who managed to get into this thing, some foe and some friend. So the whole thing is just gone. As far as I'm concerned, it's depressing to see how badly this was handled.
Very depressing. Last point.
Keep yourself above the fray. So it's absolutely brave.
Yeah, that's one way to say it.
Yeah, cynically.
Yes, absolutely. But you know, here's an important legal point. How do you balance the requirement of mens rea, which you've just talked about, the guilty mind, and the fact that ignorance of the law does not excuse?
That's easy. The mens rea, what he was doing, he said she did not know that this was illegal. That's just completely irrelevant to the case. First of all, it's probably false, but it's always irrelevant. Could you imagine running a system of murder law in which people said, well, I didn't know it was wrong to kill people in cold blood. I thought that you could do it if you had a good religious cause or something of the sort. We never allow it to anybody else. It's also the question is that the actus reus is wrong. It's not the question of releasing the information to the Russians. It's putting putting it in a place where it's in harm's way. So the whole thing, as far as I'm concerned, is just a complete charade. It's kind of sad to see the way in which it works. But, you know, if you're a liberal press, you're just going to drop this thing and nobody will ever speak about it again.
So
the danger that she faces, and she knows this, is that if Mr. Putin or somebody else has this information, it could be dumped on WikiLeaks with some really embarrassing content, and they could do it within a week of the election.
That's
true.
Or
they could blackmail her. All of these things.
And a lot of people would like to see that happen. What is the conventional wisdom here? I know you're not a soothsayer and you don't have a crystal ball, but will this have an impact as we move forward in this election, or is it going to fall by the wayside?
Well, I think, in effect, unless somebody else wants it to have an effect, it won't. But if I were somebody who was hostile to the United States and I thought that I could roil America, either blackmailing her or revealing stuff which makes it less likely for her to win, putting Trump in because you think he's an unguided missile, who knows? But I'd have to think of what the strategies are, not only of the Russians, but of 20 other nations who may have this kind of information as well. Remember, it's not as though when you hack something, you seal it up so that nobody else can hack it after you. So my guess is all of our allies in NATO have this information. All of the people in the Middle East have this information. The Iranians have it. The Syrians have it. It's a very, very serious situation because her connections were worse than the typical Google stuff.
Absolutely.
So why is it that to do this? This is a woman who's always been in this particular position, but she flashes that smile and that charm, and, you know, she escapes, and then half the people in the United States literally cannot stand the sight of her because
right.
they know that it's all essentially fictional, that she has done things that none of them would be able to get away with. Just to put it in perspective, if you work in a standard business, in a tech business and so forth, or in a financial business, and you use your company machine for personal information or download personal information, company information onto your personal machine, you just get fired. I mean,
there's no question about it. And when you think of,
and
under the example that you just gave, the implications and ramifications are nothing compared to what we're facing in this situation. So having said that, when you're saying this about Hillary Clinton, now let's look at the alternative. This is what you said about the alternative.
Oh, God.
The gruesome alternative is that if he, meaning Donald Trump, becomes president, there's all too great a chance that his impetuous temperament will lead him to perform public acts that will indeed count as high crimes and misdemeanors worthy of impeachment. Wow.
Did I say something as shrewd as that?
Yes, it was Trump unhinged senseless attacks on sitting judges do not a president make in Ricochet, June 6, 2016.
Well, that was before all the juicy stuff.
And now you have something worse to say.
Oh, I mean, my view about this man is he just goes out of his way to stick his fingers into the eyes of other people. You can say whatever you want to say about using people whose children have been killed as part of a political campaign. And, you know, I can understand arguments about that. But to sort of denigrate the parents as traitors or fools, to make cheap psychological statements about the position of the mother who lost her son a dozen years ago, it's just so tasteless that it's absolutely frightening.
But does that – let me just add for one second.
Down.
Richard, I want to ask you to be devil's advocate for one second.
Yeah.
Does that give – Mr. Khan the right to say whatever he wants about Donald Trump, or did Donald Trump just not handle it well? Because there's a school of thought, there's those closet Trump supporters who, when they get behind closed doors and have to vote and are going to vote for Trump, some people are thinking, can't the man defend himself? Or when someone, regardless of what, you know, what happened to Mr. Khan's son, can he just go and throw the salvos at Donald Trump and he has to be quiet?
Well, no, he doesn't have to be quiet. The question is how you attack it. And one of the things that you could start to say is that, you know, this is a great personal tragedy, but it doesn't bear on the soundness of policies. There were many people who were killed, and it's the Democrats and him who made this into a serious political issue by injecting it into a Democratic National Convention. That's all he has to say. He doesn't have to impugn the integrity of the poor fellow who was dead.
Absolutely.
Who did nothing wrong. And you know what? It's just bad politics because it's the kind of thing that people who dislike Trump can point to.
So,
and it opens him up to the charge. He's just not a fit human being for public office. I mean, the only debate I know amongst various people who are kind of libertarians and conservatives is a depressing debate. There are some people say we have to stick with this guy because she's worse. And there are other people who say we can't vote for either.
Yeah. So there you go. I think you just answered a question. Maybe it should be Richard Epstein for president, because you certainly can handle these issues, most people can, in a very sophisticated and classy way, which Donald Trump obviously can't. But it begs the question, when you talk about alternatives, Gary Johnson, why can't the Libertarian Party gain any traction?
I don't follow it closely enough to see what he says. But one of the things.
Let me tell you one thing. Recently, Richard, we had Larry Elder, a conservative, he calls himself a libertarian, on the program, and he was the moderator of the libertarian debate when they were trying to select a nominee.
Yeah.
And he said that most of the discussion was about legalizing marijuana.
Well, the Libertarian Party has a huge industry for self-destruction. It's hard to really get behind somebody if they're going to take an extremely passive position with respect to the use of military force overseas. That was, in the end, what sunk Rand Paul.
Yeah.
It was clear that unless there was a direct intervention in the United States, he didn't want to intervene, by which time it may well be too late. And we don't know whether or not Johnson is going to stick to that. The Libertarians also get fixated on the zero tax regime, and they really want to have a president debate whether the tax level should be lowered to zero, so you can't have a military and a public court system and things like that. You don't want to be there. What you want to do is to be a classical liberal, in which you recognize the needs for taxes, but you try to limit it in two ways. The distribution of the burden across citizens, so it can't be heavily on one small group of people like the super rich, and then the purposes for which it could be spent.
So we have to take a quick break. After the break,
I'm going to probably have to leave in a minute. The moment this phone call comes, I'm going to have to do another show. But try to take a break, and if I'm still here, I'll still be
okay.
Here.
We'll try and get back to you for a couple more minutes. Richard Epstein, thanks for talking with us. We'll be right back.
Sanborn, side by side on their first ever tour together, August 21st in the Thousand Oaks Civic Arts Plaza. Tickets at the box office and at Ticketmaster.com.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Gallagher, CEO of Coastal Payroll. BBB knows that we pride ourselves on being the most respected provider of workforce management solutions in California by making a positive impact on the lives of our clients. Earning an A-plus rating from the BBB shows that we never waver from our values and we try to be better every day. Our BBB accreditation puts us on the short list of payroll service companies BBB has verified. Coastal Payroll invites you to check out our reviews at BBB.org.
Yes? Who's it?
Hey, this is Dr. Drew.
And I'm Mike Catholic.
And on the next Midday Live, we will take your calls.
And some of the stuff that Trump is saying is explainable.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, Allah. It's Allah's fault.
He's making Trump say stupid things.
That's right.
There is a Muslim gentleman who's alleging that Allah is causing Trump to make stupid mistakes.
Of course.
Good times. That's on the next Midday Live with Dr. Mike Catholic on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
We are back. It's Alan Gervie. I'm talking to Richard Epstein, who has been called one of the most extraordinary legal scholars of this generation for good reason. If you're listening to this program, you can understand why. Richard, I know we only have you for a couple more minutes because you've got a lot of media to do today. I have a question. Last year, in an article called Don't Strangle Uber, you wrote the clear lesson to learn from the fiasco. And you're talking about Uber and independent contractor status, etc. But there's an interesting quote you have here. The learn from this fiasco is that it is hopeless task to apply traditional regulatory structures to modern arrangements, especially when they block the implementation of new business models. When you write that, are you saying that the Constitution is outdated as well and we shouldn't be turning to the Constitution to answer these difficult questions?
No, because the Constitution is a governance structure. I'm talking about the
I'm talking theory, though.
And
the theory.
I've always defended, in fact, I wrote a paper very recently on Hayek and the constitutional liberty, saying if you actually understood how the original structure was put together and get rid of the obvious problems with slavery and similar issues, the structure actually works better today than it did in 1787. So that you can't.
What about technology, Richard?
Well, Well, that's the point. So to give you an illustration, you know, Congress has the power to regulate commerce amongst the several states. It's not tied to horse and buggies. If it turns out you get telecommunications that go between two states, you could regulate it. And if it stays within one state, you can't. And that's exactly what the situation was with the Pony Express and the horse and buggy. And it's a pretty good situation. You don't want the government at the federal level to upset competition between the states, and you don't want states at the national level to be able to block commerce going back and forth between two different states, because then you balkanize the system. And so the American pattern represents not the current European Union, which is a huge mistake,
right,
but the earlier customs union, in which what you do is you have low barriers on the one hand and very little direct regulation. And so you don't think of that. The problem is the Fair Labor Standards Act was never a good idea, because you don't want to mandate overtime rules and part-time rules or anything of that sort, but it tied everything to an hour as the workable unit of exchange. And in 1938, when it was passed, you know, 96% of the wage earners were on an hourly basis. In a gig economy, nobody knows what time is. You're not in a – can't monitor it. And so what happens is, when you start putting wage and hour restrictions on it, as they've done recently, you can destroy an entire business. And when you destroy an entire business model, you can send these guys out. Just today, I went across another thing that they're going to try and kill Airbnb by making sublets illegal for short terms in a variety of jurisdictions like Los Angeles and so forth.
Right.
So what happens is a lot
of this is political, though.
Yeah, of course it is. But if you had a sensible constitutional regime, you would never allow that regime to stifle competition by innovation. And that was the model that was used in the period between 1870 and 1940, not perfectly, but roughly speaking. And I'm just going to end on this one note.
Go ahead.
If you try to check the rate of material progress in the United States, longevity, so it's not just objective things, but also subjective benefits and so forth, there's no period in the history of law, in the history of the world, that did as well as American laissez-faire, 1870 to 1940. And so what happens is, this is the period of the most retrograde constitutional doctrine, and it's also the period of the most powerful and innovative technology that the world had ever seen. If you think about the gaps in medicine and technology and transfers and all the other stuff, it's an amazing switch, and it took place under this so-called obsolete situation. And then when you get to 1937 and they throw it over, if you actually look at the arguments, they're pathetically weak. What they do, in effect, is they assume that competition doesn't give rise to wage increases. You need forced monopolization through in labor
so
or in agricultural
last question,
markets and so
yeah,
forth.
Richard, just, I have to remind you, you have to leave. Last question.
Yeah.
What for our future here? What do we do? With everything you've said, what do we do with this upcoming election? How do we turn the United States around?
Well, what you do is, I think, I don't do this, but clearly the Republican Senate has got to be a break. And if you're going to vote for Hillary Clinton, you should really want to have divided powers. And then what you have to do is to hope that the limitations on executive power for unilateral action, which have been marked with some degree of success, will hold. I don't think, no matter who wins this presidential election, you could expect any intelligent reform from the top. What you're trying to do is to give ground slowly to a series of forces that I regard as populist in danger, and it's an open question as to whether it could be done. I think when somebody like Charles Koch, who's a very shrewd guy, says, you know, I'm supporting Republican nominees down the ticket, not at the top,
He's
basically adopting that strategy.
Yeah, I think
it's a good strategy.
It is stage advice. Richard Epstein, thanks very much. It's been enlightening. We appreciate you coming on Gurvey's Law today.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. Richard Epstein has joined an illustrious group of academics and scholars who have been on Gurvey's Law, including Alan Dershowitz, Brian Leiter, Cass Sunstein, Erwin Chemerinsky, William Eskridge, Michael McConnell, Eugene Volokh, and a host of others. Check us out on Facebook, Gurvey's Law on Facebook, and listen to podcasts at rgw.com. That's www.rgw.com. Thanks for listening today. We'll see you next week.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervey & Wynn.